and suck. I mean, she's worth it. First it was spin class, and that didn't work out because of the fact that I had severe chafing and broke out with a rash within the first three shitty songs the spinner guy was playing. Listen, I don't like to ride a bike in real life, so why the fuck would I enjoy being in a dark room spinning with disco lights and some whacked out, overly aggressive, fake ass Lance Armstrong dude screaming at me? The spin teacher had a hit or miss playlist that weaved right into 12 godforsaken minutes of EDM music with the momentous Big Ride Death Fest. They actually refer to it as the Big Ride. Well, guess what? We ain't going anywhere on the Big Ride, so cut the bullshit, pal. We're not going anywhere. We're spinning around in circles like a gang of circus monkeys all looking around to see who's gonna faint first. Needless to say, spin class wasn't for me. But then she got me into CrossFit for a while, another batch of exercises that actually have no relevance in real life. Now, honestly, I was enjoying CrossFit until I tweaked a hammy doing tire pushes. Tire pushes are when the CrossFitter, in this instance it was me, is supposed to flip a 300-pound tire up and down a gym. It's some real gooned-out Ultraman strength shit you saw 30 years ago on Wide World of Sports, but it was done by giant Swedish monsters and Russian assassins that made side money by lifting cars. That day I was doing great for about three flips, and then being Jewish happened. I fucking fell right into the middle of the tire head first and wound up getting rescued by two rough and rugged cross-training ladies who thought the whole thing was hilarious. I suffered aloud, making real fucked up noises with my head stuck between the tire. It was like a whine that echoed in the tire, and I didn't even know if anyone heard me. I have to say, it was also very lonely in that tire. I was injured, and I could not have been more Jewy and broken. It was some real Larry David shit for real. I cut my fucking forehead, and my left hamstring had no feeling. I thought I snapped it. I needed to take a CrossFit vacation for a while. My girl was embarrassed, and the people that she knew looked at her like they were saying, "Your husband's really nice, but he's not built for this shit." The trainer put me on the injured reserve list for 10 days so I could heal up and get my head straight. During my CrossFit sabbatical, I started questioning how I got injured in the first place. Did I overthrow the tire? Were my legs too long to bend and lift? Was this shit really made for shorter people who didn't have to bend so far to reach the tire? Chuck, my CrossFit guru and cock-dieseled hipster trainer, convinced me that these exercises are basic and functional, and there was no reason for me to fall headfirst into a tire that was already on the ground. And I started thinking about that word functional. Chuck loved that fucking word. Functional. How fucking functional is flipping a 300-pound tire up and down the road? It's 2017 right now. They have tow trucks and all sorts of services that can help you with that kind of shit. Functional my ass. Do I own a truck scrapyard? When the fuck would I ever even need this skill? I don't live on a farm. I don't own a tractor that's never going to break down in the middle of a cornfield I've never been on. There is nothing functional about a 47-year-old man doing tire flips in a Silver Lake CrossFit gym with a gang of dudes with beards and no body fat. My next fuck CrossFit, this is not for me epiphany, hit me during my injury break while looking at my severely calloused hands. My hands looked like I had spent years building skyscrapers and used sandpaper for lotion. I didn't wear gloves for a little while, and I regret it. The CrossFit community, which I love and respect, will never admit this publicly, but they look down on people who wear gloves when they work out. Well, let me tell you something, my friends. I have the hands of a fucking ballerina. I always have. They're soft, and I'm proud of it. These hands ain't made for powerlifting. These hands are big, soft, fragile, and they should be used for playing piano at the same time when I was playing ball. I need gloves to protect these puppies, but out of respect, I went gloveless for a bit. I was doing pull-ups and motherfucking burpees gloveless for 3 months, and my hands looked like they had committed heinous crimes, and they felt fucked up. And I was getting glove-shamed every time I asked Chuck for my construction gloves for the thick, no reason to do this either unless I'm climbing down a building during a fire rope climbing class. If you've never done CrossFit, they have lumberjack ropes that are hanging from the gym ceiling. These are ropes that people use for towing boats and holding barges on docks and shit. It's the same type of shit they were using before cables were invented and they still had pirate boats. The ropes are on another level of thick and rough. but I finally learned to climb the fucking rope to the top of the ceiling that was 16 feet high and rang a bell. It was actually a great feeling, a feeling of accomplishment, a feeling of breaking through to the other side. You know what else it felt like? It felt like I was tricked and the teacher wanted me dead. What they didn't teach you in the rope class was how to come down from the deadly rope without hurting yourself. I got Indian burns on my legs on the way down, and my bleeding hands were ripping apart and had me crying on the inside like a fucking circus acrobat who fell and tried to act fine about it. I looked at my severely Indian burned arms and legs, and I was blank-faced and bleeding out. What the fuck is functional about being able to climb a rope? They have elevators and stairs and escalators now. Yeah, it was cool and it was impressive to wife-wife, but you know what else is impressive? Me eating 11 slices of Patsy's Pizza the night Larry Johnson hit that four-point play versus the Indiana Pacers in 1999. My boys couldn't believe what the fuck they were seeing. They still talk about me pulling that off without barfing. I had an iron stomach that night. And you know what else is impressive? Sitting happily for 7 hours straight during the NFL playoffs in one sports bar, trying out all their different flavors of hot wings. Why isn't that considered impressive? Fuck all this hardcore training for events that don't happen in life. Flip a tire, climb a rope, jump on a box, dangle from the monkey bars. Why don't they come up with real functional workouts? Why don't I just open and close the car door 50 times? Why don't I just pick up a 20-pound bag of ice 40 times to be ready for when the fellas come over to watch the games? Or why don't I work out on my wrist on the barbecue on and off switch in case that day ever comes? Fuck these non-functional functional workouts. I decided to call Chuck the trainer after my bleeding rope episode, and I told him I'm retiring from CrossFit. He called me a pussy. I told him to go fuck himself, take his kettlebells, and jump into a river. I seriously said that. I said, jump into the fucking ocean with your kettlebells and tell me how functional that feels, you prick-lipped function fuck. Needless to say, my wife was pissed. But luckily, she started to take hot yoga and was thinking about becoming a certified yoga teacher. And I was all for it. I wanted to support her, and this was something I could actually do. No blood, no gloves, no hate. Plus, yoga is something I've practiced over the years, and I actually like it. I'm surprisingly good at it, too. I have a naturally perfect downward dog pose. No bullshit. It's one of those weird things. You know, growing up, I could always touch my toes. When I played basketball, I was never the best shooter, best rebounder, or best defensive player, but I was always the best stretcher. Real talk. At Erasmus Hall High School, Coach Bunyan would have me lead the team in pre-practice warm-ups and say shit like, watch Rappaport stretch. He's as flexible as a Honduran hooker on a Sunday. The whole team was confused by Mr. Bunyan's analogies, but at least I was the best at something, and stretching was always it. You know, I willingly stretch every day, and I'll do it any place, any moment I feel a tweak, tightness, or I'm emotionally unstable. When my kids were 11 and 9, they actually named me the street stretcher. Because when we walk around New York City, I would stop on a dime, throw my leg on top of a mailbox just to get a nice deep calf stretch. They were always humiliated, yet impressed. So I was totally down with my lady going to hot yoga, and I wanted in on that action. This was something I could do. Immediately, we started going 4 to 5 times a week, and I loved it. They played dope music in a 50-minute class, and I started to get in great shape, and I was really enjoying myself. Things were going really well on all levels. I was long, I was lean, and I was limber. My general wingspan was getting wider, and I was breathing deeper. I was even noticing weird shit, like when I waved to people, my fingers spread out more. The yoga was working. My anger spurts were diminishing, and my girl was shocked at how calm I was in restaurants, public spaces, and even on the phone where I was known to lose it. And then, things started going south in yoga. One day, after an extremely hot, near-death, sweaty heat class, I got up to walk out like I usually did, and there were fucking sweat puddles all over the goddamn floor. It was like a goddamn rainstorm happened in the class. Now listen, I don't do well with other people's sweat in general, but you put buckets of ass and back sweat around the room, I'm gonna lose it. I was hopping around the class like a frickin' frog on a lily pad looking to get around the water. I didn't understand how everyone else in the class was so calm and relaxed. And on that, everything is one. Everything is part of the same universe. We're all just molecules connected shit. I was thinking, there's no way I'm stepping in homeboy's back to ass sweat. And if I do, I'm never coming back to this fucking yoga place. The entire yoga thing started backfiring on me. I told my wife, I says, I don't want to go back. This place is disgusting. And my wife said, you're being a germaphobe, and it was good for me and that I had to go back. So I said, fine, of course, I'll go back. So a few days later in a class, I was doing my thing in my perfect downward dog, and the teacher came over and tried to pull some prison shit on me. This fucking guy held my hips and started whispering some shit in my ear about me being too tight and that I needed to let my childhood go and drop the pain in my soul. The motherfucker had me in a hip grip with a twist of mind control thrown in. Believe me when I tell you, I know some of these yoga fucks are on some weird cult control shit here, but that's not even my point here. This was a man with both hands on me, telling me to let go of all my shit and that he was going to be there for me when it was all over. I didn't like it. I didn't like it at all. I didn't feel right about it, and I swear I left that class with a fucking sliver of my manhood taken away. And I told my lady, I said, I'm not going back. There's no way I'm going back. She wasn't having it. And I was back 2 weeks later for what would be my final class with other people. But I'm telling you, this was not my fault either. The class was going okay, and I was breathing deeply, and my girl was breathing near me, and we were all good on a Saturday afternoon. And then Fuckface Von Stretchberg tells the class that we need to go deep and breathe from our stomachs and let it all go. Well, guess what, kids? When I breathe deep, I exhale, and sounds are made, and they ain't fucking silent. That's right. I was taught as a young athlete and as a karate student during my 4 weeks of karate that when you exhale, you blow it out. And when you blow it out, sometimes a sound comes out, sometimes even a grunt. Well, when I started exhaling, it started coming out somewhere between a ha and a ho. But it was purely natural. I wasn't doing it for attention. It was just my lungs kicking out my natural breath, and I felt great. I felt organic. I felt like it was working. Well, here comes this teacher, and he tells me, Michael, I'm sorry. You're disturbing the class. And he was telling me this while I'm half upside down and feeling good about myself. I was pissed. This is how I breathe. You want to tell me to go deep and bring it up and exhale? Well, this is what you get, my friend. This is what you get from me. When I got home, my girl was pissed. She actually told me that she thought I was disruptive and that people were making faces at her since they knew she was with me. Well, guess what, yogis? Have at it. I'm going solo on that ass. I'm done with the cultish classes, judgmental techniques, and now I do private yoga all by myself. I make all the loud noises I want, and I don't skip over nasty-ass sweat puddles from other people. Plus, there's no teachers trying to have their way with me midway through class. So namaste, bitches. Even when we suck, New York City is still the Mecca. New York City is the Mecca of basketball, and Madison Square Garden is its crown jewel. Now I know a lot of you Rappaport pundits from all corners of the world are going to challenge me on this fact, and that's fine. I know you all tout your city and how it has great marquees as well. I know Detroit produced some of the greatest players ever to play the game. And the Pistons played at the palace of where the hell is Auburn Hills. And yes, I know that Chicago has churned out tons of legends from the parks and the public school system. And people love the United Center and treat it like it's sacred ground. I've heard it all before. But nothing, and I mean nothing, could touch New York City. And no building can ever touch the world's most famous arena. The average Rappaport critic, and there are legions of them, we'll say, Mike Rapp, stop it with all that New York City, Madison Square Garden nonsense. The Knicks haven't won shit since 1973. St. John's hasn't been mentionable since Chris Mullin had the floppy hair. And New York City doesn't have any homegrown stars in the NBA. Listen, I know it. I know it all. But it means nothing. Nada. Zilch. You cannot rewrite history, people. Before the NBA was the big business we all know it as, there was only college basketball to pay attention to. And all the big games and major tournaments happened in New York City at the old Madison Square Garden. Look, I'm not going to sit here and pretend it doesn't hurt that the Knicks haven't won jack shit since I was 3 years old. I was actually in a double-legged diaper cast after breaking my leg in the spring of 1973 when the Knicks won their last championship. You have any idea how humiliating it was for me to hobble around New York City in a double-legged diaper cast? It fucking sucked. I was jumping on my bed, fell, and broke my femur. I didn't even get a chance to go to the parade. And not winning since 1973 is shameful. It hurts. It hurts bad. And I feel it every day when I wake up and look at the posters of Earl the Pearl Monroe on my bedroom wall, even though I'm pushing 50 years old. It also hurts that New York City doesn't produce the born and bred talent that it used to, and it isn't sending kids to the NCAA or the NBA like we've been known for. That shit is emotional and it stings. But life is a big circle and things come back around, my friend. We will rise again from the streets of New York City and take off like a rocket ship into the stratosphere. But these times are crippling for a guy like me who loves to talk shit and has been perfecting the art since I was thrown out of New York City public schools for it. But knowing the Garden's history and knowing that we're bound to come back gives me real hope. And at this point, a little hope is all I'm fucking looking for. Before the NBA was the gigantic business it is today, with nonstop coverage, statistics filling up every space, and access to star players through social media, the Garden was the place to be. Before Charles, Kenny, and the TNT crew did their thing, people were talking about Madison Square Garden as if it was the star. When college hoops was at its height, and we were locked into watching NCAA basketball at its peak, Madison Square Garden was the epicenter. And please don't make me go all the way back to sold-out Garden appearances by P.T. Barnum and my dude Pickle the Clowns to make my point. You know what I'm talking about. The old Garden on 8th Avenue was the spot, and if you played there, the eyes of the world were watching you. And the NBA doesn't get big without New York winning, period. Listen, I'm no history major, but let me lay it out for you. From 1957 through 1969, the Boston Celtics won every NBA championship except one. I'm sure that was great for Boston Celtics fans, and it probably gave some twisted hope for Laker fans that lost in the finals 7 times during that period, but unfortunately, the rest of the country didn't give a shit about it. The fact is, the NBA wasn't considered a mainstream attraction until the New York Knicks started winning games, and that, my friends and angry pundits, happened with the 1970 New York Knicks crew. When that 1970 championship team was organically drafted and traded to make all the pieces fit, they represented New York City and everything about it. Willis Reed, the captain, he was only a second-round pick but brought a toughness and work ethic that the city appreciated. And when he beat up the entire Lakers team in a bench-clearing brawl in 1966, we knew we had our guy. If you never seen the footage, look it up on YouTube. It happened. He beat the entire team up by himself. New Yorkers loved him, and we recognized we had somebody special going to war for all of us. Then Bill Bradley. Bradley was a star like no other when he got to the Knicks. Women were showing up to games just to see Dollar Bill on the layup line. The hype was like nothing the league had ever seen. He was like a one-man boy band. The closest thing to compare it to was Lynn Sanity. Remember that shit? Fucking Lynn Sanity was like some alien landing shit. And Bradley came in and represented that upper-class white Fifth Avenue alien that rounded out our gritty pack of wolves. The biggest star turned out to be Walt Frazier. Clyde was the first of his kind in pro sports. Every athlete in every sport now comes into the league having already branded themselves and are stockpiled with endorsements. Well, Walt Clyde Frazier was a groundbreaker. He was the first professional athlete to have a sneaker named after him. He was the first to become a mainstream, fully marketable black athlete. And that happened because the real-life madmen of Madison Avenue were sitting courtside at Knick games watching Frazier emerge. And those madmen knew they had something special. Clyde was the coolest guy in sports and maybe the coolest guy to walk the streets of New York City. No other player was rocking canary gold with zebra patterns and a pimped out brim before a game. He played the role of style god on and off the court. And they called him Clyde because of the wide brim Bonnie and Clyde hat that legendary stickman Warren Beatty made famous in the movie. When we got Dave DeBuscher in the trade from Detroit, he came in looking like a blue-collar workhorse straight off an 8-mile road, and the city loved him for it. The great Dick Barnett, Jazzy Cazzy Russell, and the openly hippy-dippy smoke-it-if-you-got-it Phil Jackson were a perfect fit for our New York City character-driven team. Red Holzman, the coach, was a tough streetball-playing New York City Jew that coached like the borough of Brooklyn was running through his veins. That team looked like they play. Every player represented an aspect of New York. They represented the big dreams and harsh realities of the city. That slogan, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere, was never more apparent in that lineup and the work ethic of the 1970 Knicks. And when they started winning games, it was Madison Square Garden that became a real-life Broadway show. Fuck Hamilton, fuck Cats, and fuck Les Miserables. Nothing was as exciting in 1970 as the Knicks in Madison Square Garden. The celebrities started showing up every night. Barbara Streisand, Woody Allen, Bill Cosby, Frank Sinatra, and everyone else in between. Celebrities didn't go to hoop games before that 1970 championship team. Even the great Laker teams in Los Angeles didn't get triple-A list stars that the Knicks were getting during the 69-70 season. The entertainment value in the entire league shot up when the Knicks took that championship. It happened right before our eyes and in dramatic fashion. When a young Marv Albert said, "Here comes Willis, here comes Willis," as the limping Knicks captain made his way onto the Garden floor and led the Knicks in crushing the Lakers, it was written in stone. The Lakers' original big three of Wilt Chamberlain, Elgin Baylor, and Jerry the Logo West had their plans ruined in the brand new Madison Square Garden. The new garden gave new life to an already amazing city. If you've never been there, Madison Square Garden is within eyeshot of the Empire State Building and a 15-minute walk to Central Park. And when you walk around New York City today, you'll notice that there's outdoor basketball courts within a mile radius everywhere you go in the five boroughs. Basketball is actually part of the architectural fabric of New York, and that will never go away. The new Madison Square Garden opened in 1969 and is the only original arena left in the NBA. So although our Knicks haven't won the chip since 1973, NBA players, pro fighters, Miley Cyrus, and every single person that makes their way in the Garden knows that this is the exact same building where Clyde had 36-19 in Game 7 versus the Lakers, the same exact roof that Ali fought Frazier under in 1971, and it's the same exact seating arrangement that Frank Sinatra performed live to in 1974. The Boston Garden is gone. The Staples Center is cool, but it will never have the mystique of the Fabulous Forum. And do I really need to mention other places like the fucking Smoothie King Arena in New Orleans? I don't think so. Madison Square Garden is the last remaining NBA arena with all its history intact. And that means everything. So like it or not, the Garden will always be the world's most famous arena, and New York City will always be the Mecca. The irony of Charles Oakley. Of all the lowlights the Knicks have gone through the past few years, watching the Charles Oakley incident on live TV blew my fucking mind. I couldn't believe what I was seeing, and I damn sure couldn't believe who I was seeing it happen to. I was actually embarrassed to be a New York Knicks fan that day. You don't do Charles Oakley like that. No fucking way. Not only did they arrest Charles Oakley in Madison Square Garden, but the way they handled it afterwards was disgusting and against everything we as Knicks fans stand for. That's our dude. And they hit him with disorderly conduct and some other bullshit charges. And at the moment of writing this book, James Dolan, the owner of the Garden, the Knicks, and $1 billion worth of other shit, still hasn't dropped the charges. We're talking about Charles Oakley, the same security guards and police officers who grew up in the tri-state area watching Oakley dive all over the garden floor for loose balls, set smashing picks, grab rebound after rebound, and protect the players that needed to be protected, were now ordered to arrest him. The irony. Oakley went to war for the team he represented. Oakley was the guy for us, the guy that you need on your team. That dude doesn't do the talking. That dude does the hard work, and he did it for the last relevant Knick team you can remember. They physically escorted him to the tunnel, the same tunnel he used to lead the beloved 90s Knicks teams down before they hit the floor. Then in some sort of bullshit show of force, they put him in a Muay Thai Krav Maga Jiu-Jitsu armbar and sit him on the floor. And all this was happening on national TV while the Garden crowd cheered, "Oakley, Oakley, Oakley." It was filthy. Arresting Charles Oakley in the Garden is like arresting the Pope at the Vatican. He means that much to Knicks fans. He is us. He's what we represent. The hard-nosed, tough-it-out, workman-like mentality that built New York. And you want to surround him and take him down in his house? Oakley gave us what is real about New York City. The real New York shit. Not the Sex and the City fashion-forward Soho version with a twist of lemon New York. No, I'm talking about the motherfuckers that clear your streets, that make sure your garbage gets picked up. The people that build those skyscrapers you're so proud of. I'm not talking about the man-bun, coffee-shop, hipster-fuck Brooklyn version that Lena Dunham so gladly portrays on her HBO show Girls. That ain't New York. That's some bullshit. That's some elitist, take your clothes off even when you shouldn't because you read a few books and you went to a few art exhibits bullshit. Charles Oakley is the real New York. Charles Oakley is us. Oakley represented the heart and soul of New York, and that's how you want to do him? Do you understand what a guy like that does for your team? Does for your players? You know what it means to have protection on a team? To have that bodyguard on the squad that makes sure you don't get taken advantage of? Every team needs a Charles Oakley. You think Patrick Ewing could have been Patrick Ewing without knowing that Oak had his back? You think John Starks didn't get that extra confidence knowing damn well Oakley had straight goon tendencies if he needed them? And don't tell me we already had that with the late, great Anthony Mason. Because as truly badass as Mason was, and we all know he was, Charles Oakley was ready to go when it was game time. He was the necessary cog in that machine. That character is needed on every team in sports. You don't have Gretzky without McSorley or Yazerman without Probert. Your stars can't shine without the confidence of knowing they have protection. Why do you think Kobe loved having Ron Artest around? Because he knew damn well that if shit went down, Ron was ready to throw down for the greater cause. That intangible tough guy shit is real, and it represents the struggle of the people and the work ethic of the every man. So when James Dolan played Oakley like that, he set the stage for a rebellion. And what you got was backlash you didn't see coming. Well, I'm here to let you know it wasn't cool, it wasn't right, and if you ask me, it was on some bitch shit that doesn't fly in the New York City streets. Oakley told you he's not comfortable with five dudes coming over and getting in his face at once. Why would he be? You rush him like that, and his first thought is to swing. And you're lucky all he did was finger push that dude in the temple. And you saw how strong that finger was, too. That finger is no joke. He finger templed that dude, and the dude looked like his head might snap off. James Dolan, you really thought it was a good idea to send your security goon squad over to surround Charles Oakley like that? Come on, my man. That was some uncalled for shit, and the crowd and the people let you know what they thought right as it was happening. And now the streets and the media were talking and they weren't feeling you, my man. And I was happy to talk to anyone who was on the fence. The very next day I had a conversation with Fox Sports All Everything personality Colin Cowherd. He didn't understand why Oakley meant so much to Knicks fans, which bugged me out. And I thought he was actually kidding. I told him, Charles Oakley means the same thing to Knicks fans that Eric Dickerson's offensive line meant to LA Rams fans. The same thing that Rick Mahorn meant to the bad boy Detroit Piston fans. I had to explain it to him, which again was baffling, but I had no choice. Don Corleone is not Don Corleone if he doesn't have Luca Brasi. Charles Oakley is our guy, and he don't sleep with no fishes. Oak did it on the biggest stage under the brightest lights for 10 years straight. And it doesn't matter that those Knicks teams didn't win a championship. Yeah, they came up short and it sucks, but we went down fighting, punching, finger waving, and face smacking, and Charles Oakley was on the front lines all day, every day. And since we're on the subject of disrespecting classic Knicks, I have to say there's been a few other notable shows of disrespect to classic Knick players and family members in the James Dolan era. James Dolan, you motherfucker. You fired the great Marv Albert for questioning the team's choices and abilities? Motherfucking Marv Albert is as much of a Knick as Walt Clyde Frazier, Willis Reed, and Patrick Ewing. He was a goddamn ball boy for the Knicks when he was a teenager at the Old Garden on 49th and 8th Avenue. And he got fired by Dolan for questioning the Knicks? What the fuck is the matter with you? I thought you had a soul. I thought you understood loyalty. Aren't you in a blues band? What the hell, man? And by the way, what the hell is the name of your blues band? Is it called the Billionaire Blues Players of Madison Avenue? And what are you singing about? The sadness of overcooked chicken by your personal chef? Or the angry nanny who wouldn't do what you asked? Are you jamming to the pain of growing up wealthy and don't understand the common man? Yo, send me one of your blues albums. I'd love to hear it as I am a true lover of the blues. We're New Yorkers, man. We stand by our team through thick and thin because it's in our blood. But Dolan, you're making it real fucking difficult. I mean, maybe you don't give a damn since games are sold out no matter who's on the court and what the team plays like. I don't know. I don't work in the front office, but I'm damn sure getting fed up, and the Oakley incident only pushed us all closer to the edge. I don't need to recap the poor choices on and off the court by the Knicks front office in the James Dolan era. It's too frustrating to articulate, and I'm going to start to mumble. But the fans, as frustrated as we are, keep coming back for more. We boo, we complain, and we yell and scream on the tri-state area sports shows all week long, but it's fallen on deaf ears. And that Charles Oakley incident represented all that frustration. Charles Oakley getting arrested inside of Madison Square Garden after being accused of heckling James Dolan was Shakespearean, if you ask me. Oak said what was on every single one of our minds. He was the one who had the balls to say it, and he did. We all want to go up to Dolan and say, what the fuck have you done? You have taken the New York Knicks and turned us into a fucking joke since you got this building and this team handed to you by your father, and you have ruined it, you fuck you. Take your bullshit blues band and beat it, you spoiled little rich prick, and do yourself a favor. Shave that funky ass beard. You look fucking ridiculous. All Knick fans have thought about saying that to James Dolan. I hear people practicing that exact speech on the streets before Knick games, but no one had the balls to say it. But Charles Oakley did. One of the toughest, most beloved players in New York City sports history said what we were all thinking, and he paid the price. The fucking irony. Charles the sacrificial lamb Oakley. He spoke for the people, and you locked him up. Get the fuck out of here with that behavior. Rumor has it that a Knicks fan went down to the police precinct that night and bailed Oakley out, only in New York. Listen up. You don't want to turn the clock back to the 80s, do you? When we could buy cheap seats and walk down and sit in the second row because the garden was empty? Well, you're pushing your luck. You never, never, ever disrespect your top lieutenant. And Charles Oakley is our top lieutenant. The eviction of Phil Jackson, an absurd one-act play.
Note, sometime during the summer of 2017, there was a secret trial held in New York City in the U.S. District Court of Appeals where Phil Jackson and his team attempted to reconcile his situation with the New York Knickerbockers. These are the actual transcripts from this secret trial. Inside the New York State Court of Appeals, the jury patiently assembles while Phil Jackson and his lawyer, Kurt Rambis, sit idly at the defense table awaiting opening statements from the prosecution. Michael Rappaport, representing himself, paces briskly back and forth in front of Phil and Kurt, staring them down as he prepares for the appeal. Kurt looks at him like he's crazy. Rappaport waves an index finger at Kurt Rambis and Phil Jackson as if to say, "No, not in here you don't. This is my town."
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, we will now hear the prosecution's argument in the case of Phil Jackson versus the City of New York. Mr. Jackson has been granted a hearing in the U.S. District Court of Appeals following his release from the New York Knicks organization. The court will now hear from the prosecution. Mr. Rappaport will be representing himself in the case. Mr. Rappaport.
Rappaport stands up, takes out a cigarette, and puts it in his mouth.
Mr. Rappaport, there's no smoking in the courtroom.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I didn't see the sign.
There is no sign. It's the law.
Are you sure?
Mr. Rappaport.
Rappaport tucks the cigarette back into his suit and paces in front of the jury, all of whom look mildly concerned.
Mr. Rappaport, you have the floor.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. I was dying for that cigarette. I want you out of this city, Jackson.
This is no place for your personal sentiment.
It's all personal.
Either present your case or I'll toss it right out.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I apologize. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury and the great city of New York, I ask you as both citizens and fans of the New York Knickerbockers to please understand that this hurts me as much as it hurts you, but there is no other option here than to keep Phil Jackson out of the great city of New York and away from the New York Knicks. Phil Jackson was rightfully fired from the Knicks, and I am here today saying that I want him far away from the city. Let Phil Jackson go back to his happy place where he can meditate, relax, nibble on some peyote, or go to Peru, where ayahuasca is all the rage.
Objection.
I object to your haircut, Rambo. Did your head sleep with a raccoon?
Excuse me?
What's the excuse?
What the hell does my hair have to do with anything?
Da-ha! You see, that right there shows that everyone was out of touch in this Knicks organization, including you and your goddamn barber.
What?
Rappaport grabs a piece of licorice from his jacket and rips into it.
Mr. Rappaport, please refrain from eating in the courtroom.
I'm sorry. Judge, I apologize. My blood sugar's upside down. And no one told me I couldn't eat in here.
There's a sign for that out front. Now move on.
Hey, thank you, Your Honor, I'm sorry, but his hair has been an issue for me for years, okay? I did not mean to bring it up so soon in the trial.
Don't bring it up at all.
Judge, can we move on here? My client is exhausted and has to catch a flight to the Bahamas, where he's going to get some R&R, much needed.
Phil smiles blankly off into the distance, then tries to catch what looks like a fly, but there is no fly.
Oh, I'm sorry, Phil. I'm sorry to keep you awake. For someone looking to appeal a decision, you, sure seem sleepy.
Mr. Rappaport, please continue.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. You're right. I just figured if you want to make an appeal to come back to a city and maybe get your job back, you might want to be awake for that, right?
Mr. Rappaport.
We're all fucking tired, Your Honor.
Language.
I'm exhausted, too.
Moving on.
Phil, did you or did you not hire Derek Fisher to be the head coach of the New York Knicks?
I did. He's so nice and little.
And did you consider that there were more likely qualified choices?
Is your suit yellow?
What? My suit's gray.
I love yellow.
My suit is gray, Phil.
Oh, okay.
If we don't get on with this, I'll call for a mistrial. Continue, Mr. Rappaport.
Mr. Jackson, is it true that you once played against the likes of Wilt Chamberlain, Elgin Baylor, and the great Jerry West?
Yes, that is true. We played against each other many times. I love the food trucks here. Am I coming back?
Not yet.
Okay. The gyros from the trucks on Columbus Circle? Amazing.
You're gone, Phil.
They're gone.
No, you're gone. You're whacked out, Phil. Now, Mr. Jackson, are you sure you even remember playing against those guys? Or is it possible that this is something that you have forgotten completely and have no recollection of?
Objection.
Snip the locks, Four Eyes, and stay out of the city.
I haven't left.
You will soon.
Mr. Rappaport.
Look at your fucking dome piece, Rambus.
Mr. Rappaport, this is your last warning. Now move on.
Okay, it's not a problem at all, Your Honor. I'm simply asking if he remembers playing with such legends, because I can't figure out why the hell he would hire Derek Fisher to coach the New York Knicks, someone with absolutely no coaching experience.
Your Honor, this makes no sense, and I ask that it be struck from the record.
Not now, Mr. Mullet. I'm making all the sense.
Mr. Rappaport, please remain on point before I toss you out of here.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. This is all very emotional for me. I apologize. It won't happen again. Mr. Jackson, did you know that Derek Fisher had no coaching experience at the time you hired him, and that I, too, was also available for the job?
Why would I ever think about hiring you as a coach?
Ha-ha! You see? That's a valid point, but a stupid question.
Rappaport whips out 2 8x10 photos of himself holding a giant trophy surrounded by a team full of dirty-faced 10-year-old boys in shorts and football jerseys. He thrusts the photos in front of Jackson and Rambus.
I coached my son's flag football team full of snot-nosed, uncoordinated kids with no athleticism to the Los Angeles North Valley 12-and-under championship.
Objection!
That's true. You can't object to the truth. Stay in Peru, freak.
I've never been to Peru.
Lies!
Objection withheld, Mr. Rappaport. What does this have to do with Mr. Jackson choosing you as a coach?
Everything.
Stay on subject here.
It has everything to do with it. Derek Fisher did not have a coaching background, and I did! God damn it. It's hot in here. It's sweltering. Can someone turn on the air conditioning?
The air is on.
Oh. Oh. Well, what's it on, Your Honor?
70.
I prefer it at 65. Can we please make that happen, please? I'm burning up.
The jury looks on in disbelief.
The air conditioning is staying as it is, Rappaport.
Not a problem, boss man. Not a problem. But Mr. Jackson, are you aware that Derek Fisher was willing to fist fight his former teammates in the NBA, namely Mr. Matt Barnes, over a supposed love affair with a woman?
I was not. How great is that New York skyline? And you know you can eat any time of night here. I know a dumpling place in Chinatown stays open till 3 a.m.
Are you on mushrooms, Phil?
Objection!
Overrule!
You don't overrule, I do.
Are you on acid, Phil?
Mr. Rappaport.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, but you can't tell me that Phil Jackson doesn't seem like he's hopped up on something.
Continue, please.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, need I remind you that Mark Jackson and a host of other more qualified candidates were also available for the Knicks coaching job at that time?
I knew that.
Yet you chose Derek Fisher.
I did.
This is absurd. He led us to the worst record in Knicks franchise history during 2015.
Jackson turns to Rambus and they have a quiet moment.
That true, Kurt?
It is, Phil. The team sucked.
No one told me that.
Okay, I'll look into why nobody told you about it.
Thanks, Kurt. And could you look into those vape pens while you're at it? And see about investing in an ice cream truck, too?
You got it, boss.
Thanks.
Moving on. Courtroom will adjourn for lunch soon.
That's good. That's good. By the way, there's a great deli downstairs if you're into pastrami, Your Honor.
I'm not.
Okay, well, they make a wonderful knish as well.
I'm fine, thank you.
Your loss?
I'm sure.
Phil, let me ask you a question. Were you aware that under your tenure, the New York Knicks players were getting robbed for their money and their jewelry right here in Manhattan?
I heard rumors.
Rumors? You heard rumors? It's on record, and it was in the news as well as on video. Derek Williams got $750,000 worth of jewelry taken from his hotel room.
Phil turns to Kurt.
Is that a lot?
It is substantial, Phil.
Oh, shit. Well, that won't happen again if they let me have my job back.
It ain't happening, hippie.
Sounds so confident.
And loud.
Yeah, we should all go to Rao's. What a sauce they make.
This is my point. The entire organization is lost. I'm talking about jewelry, and he's talking about meatballs. Why is he talking about meatballs?
Well, I don't wear jewelry. I like tie-dyes and loose pants. Feels great on my legs. Has a nice, airy feeling.
You're gone, Phil. You're losing it. Clay Anthony Early was robbed at gunpoint, and they even stole a tooth out of his mouth.
Well, that has to be painful. I have a great dentist. He has such soft hands.
Of course that's painful, but not as painful as having to admit you got your fucking tooth stolen. He's not Leon Spinks, for God's sakes.
I don't understand.
Of course you don't understand. Maybe this will help. They robbed those players because the New York Knicks lost all respect in this city. You think the great Patrick Ewing would have gotten robbed for his gold molar?
Mr. Rappaport.
You think Bernard King would ever get jacked in his own town for a wisdom tooth right out of his mouth?
Enough.
Hustlers, pimps, and dope dealers, they cleared the way and protected the great Knicks like Willis Reed and Earl the Pearl Monroe. They wouldn't dare think about robbing those guys.
Please note that Mr. Rappaport has lost his way and strike this information from the record.
I'll sell my own fucking tooth.
Is this necessary, Kurt?
Objection.
I'll take your fucking retainer.
I don't have a retainer.
You should have one, Kurt. Your teeth look like shit. Let me ask you this, Phil. How about a curfew?
God bless you.
I didn't sneeze. I said curfew.
Oh.
People of the jury, I ask you to look at Phil Jackson here and realize that he is no longer fit to run this team, and we must uphold the decision to keep him out of New York for the remainder of the New York Knicks' existence.
Mr. Rappaport, the jury will make the decision at the proper time. Please continue. And what, Mr. Rappaport, why are your shoes off? Please put your shoes back on.
Come on, Judge, my feet are burning up.
Put your shoes back on.
Okie dokie, you are the boss.
Rappaport unwillingly puts his shoes back on.
Mr. Jackson, did you or didn't you say you were going to have the Knicks run the famed triangle offense here in New York?
Objection, Your Honor. That offense is not understood by many people, and we ask that you strike that statement from the records.
Motion denied. Allow for the triangle offense to be kept on record. Continue.
Of course you want it thrown out. No one understood the offense. It didn't work here. It's like you were trying to teach them all trigonometry, Phil. No one gets the mystical all for one, one for all. Everyone has to touch the basketball before they shoot it. Offense. It's over, Phil. This ain't Chicago, and Jordan ain't here. The triangle offense should be banished. Can we all wake the fuck up, please? You're gone. It's gone. Goodbye.
Watch your language in the courtroom.
How can you run an offense that you yourself have forgotten?
Worked for the Bulls in 93?
That was 20 years ago.
Has it been that long, Kurt?
A little longer. Is my hair really that bad?
I never noticed.
Phil, is it true or not true that you started directing tweets to your star player, Mr. Carmelo Anthony?
Is he here?
Is he here? No. No, he's not here, Phil, and neither are you.
Is he coming?
No.
Oh, good, good. Oh, good. We never got along.
No shit, you're not getting along, Mr. Jackson. You tweeted at him like you were a scorned teenage girl. You tweeted that he should leave New York and chase the championship elsewhere. Is this or is this not ridiculous behavior coming from the one-time head of operations of a well-known and legendary franchise?
Is Porzingis on Twitter?
But Judge, he's not even answering my questions.
I love Porzingis. I tweet him. I'll miss him the most.
Please don't. Don't tweet him.
Mr. Rambis, please advise your client to answer the questions.
Rambis whispers into Phil's ear. Phil pops what looks like an edible.
Mr. Jackson, there's no eating in the courtroom.
Sorry, Judge. It's medicinal.
Excuse me.
It's my knees.
You're eating medicinal marijuana in my courtroom during your appeal?
No, sir. I'm not sure what that was. It was stuck in my pocket. My mouth was dry. It might be a caramel.
Oh. Mr. Rappaport, let's get moving here.
Judge and members of this jury, I am as upset as you are. I have shed many a man tear over this decision to pursue and uphold the eviction of the once great, and he was great, Phil Jackson from New York. This entire thing has given me a stomachache, and I already have an acid reflux issue, plus a number of gluten-related problems as well. I don't need to get in all that, but this has kept me up for weeks on end. But I cannot waver on my decision to keep Phil from coming back to New York, and I ask you, the jury, to see it the same way. To quote former Knick legend Michael Sugar Ray Richardson, this ship be sinking. The New York Knickerbockers have never sunk so low, and the city itself has never been so uniformly together on one subject, and that subject being the firm and permanent removal of Phil Jackson so we could return to the greatest sports town of all time, a city that deserves a championship team and a team that could play proud in Madison Square Garden, the world's most famous arena. Phil, I want you out of the five boroughs before it's too late. And Kurt, let's get real. You need to cut that ridiculous mullet you call a hairdo.
Objection.
Just accept that you got more scalp than hair, Rambis.
Mr. Rappaport, you're out of order.
No, Your Honor, you're out of order. He's out of order. Phil Jackson's out of order.
Mr. Rappaport, sit down.
Rappaport is in a leaning position, as if to touch his toes.
I can't, Your Honor. I'm stuck. I got an issue here. I think my back locked up on me.
Mr. Rappaport, did you not hear me?
Rappaport is now back up and running in circles in front of the jury and the defense table, waving his hands in the air as if he's won the case.
We did it! We won, ladies and gentlemen of the jury! And Judge, you can rejoice with me as well, because I know you want this burnout gone, and I know you want this appeal to fail and for him to retire and be done here! I'm well aware you canceled your season ticket package, Your Honor. Nobody wants to see it anymore. We, the people of New York, have removed Phil Jackson from this city once and for all.
Rappaport, you are in contempt. Sheriff, will you please remove Mr. Rappaport from the courtroom?
I'm a fucking winner. You're a loser, Phil. I took a group of 10-year-olds with no basic skills or no proper diet plan to a flag football championship. What the hell have you done to my city? The Statue of Liberty is shitting in her pants as we speak.
Mr. Rappaport, you are going to jail. I set your bail amount at $5,000.
That's good.
Now it's $10,000.
Even better. At least it's less than what Phil paid for players that don't even want to be here. And I will happily do my time quietly, Your Honor. And I hope they don't have a TV where you're sending me. That way I don't have to watch my dreams of living in a great sports town be crushed right in front of my eyes.
The jury is going crazy, clapping for Rappaport. The sheriff cuffs him and takes him toward the exit.
My people, I have spoken. Hey, sweetheart, grab me that cigarette from inside my pocket, will you?
The sheriff finally whisks him out of the courtroom. The door closes and the judge bangs the gavel.
Courtroom dismissed.
Phil Jackson lays his head on the table to take a nap. Rambis runs his fingers through what's left of his hair. The courtroom goes dark.
Halftime. My spiritual connection with the housewives of Bravo TV. A few years ago, I was sick and tired of watching my New York Giants getting their asses kicked on Sunday Night Football. So I shut off the TV and went to the bedroom to see what my wife was watching. She was happily leaning into Bravo's Real Housewives of Atlanta. As I was coming down from 9 hours of NFL Sunday football, I just put my head into the pillows and let the show roll over me. And I had no idea of the long-lasting treat I would be giving myself. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. The women argued, laughed, and talked so much shit to each other that I had to take notes. I asked my wife a few backstory questions about the relationships that were being slaughtered and reawoken within the same 5-minute scenes, and I kept saying, yo, is this shit real? This shit can't be real. I just couldn't believe there were real people behaving like this on television. I didn't believe these women were this funny, volatile, and open with each other, and it was all being filmed for a television show. But I was drawn in immediately. As soon as the episode ended, I wanted more. I started binge-watching past seasons of housewife shows like a fiend. I became a real-life, Real Housewives junkie. The shit started cutting into my work time. I had things to do, lines to learn, and books to write, but I couldn't focus unless I was completely caught up and done with an episode. I couldn't fucking pause. And as a prideful and seasoned shit-talker like myself, I recognized the greatness of NeNe Leakes' ability right away. NeNe Leakes is a proud former stripper who has made the most of her time on these shows. After 10 seasons on Real Housewives of Atlanta, she's carved out a nice career as a real actress and a television personality. One of the things that helped her stand out is that she is a vicious and outrageous shit talker who doesn't care about the ramifications of her tongue lashings. She can also take it as good as she gives it, which is an underrated quality of a great talker of trash. I loved NeNe immediately. Miss Leakes, in her prime on The Real Housewives of Atlanta, is as entertaining and as genuinely charismatic as Calista Flockhart was on Ally McBeal. I consider Nene my vessel into the world of Real Housewives. She's so genuine and comfortable with herself, good, bad, ugly, behaviorally speaking, that as an actor, I actually find her inspiring. But nobody, and I mean nobody, exudes total relaxation as a Real Housewife as much as the great Bethany Frankel. I refer to her as the Michael Jordan of Housewives because she left Real Housewives of New York in her prime and did the unprecedented and came back bigger, better, and stronger than ever. Bethany is truly one of the best ball breakers I've ever seen on screen or in real life for that matter. She's a combination of a young Vince Vaughn and Seattle Supersonics Gary Payton when it comes to verbal warfare. She's funny, provocative, and self-deprecating. The fact that when she started on The Real Housewives of New York, she was a regular girl who didn't know where she was going in life, and 8 years later, she created her multi-million dollar skinny girl business is some true blue, only in America type of shit. I have no idea how much money she's worth, but it's a fucking lot, and she did it all in front of the cameras. Getting to follow Bethany through relationships, marriage, and divorce, and having a kid, all while listening to her talk some of the best shit you'll ever hear, is television entertainment at its finest. The whole idea of following sort of regular people on their personal journeys is always compelling. And I don't care what anyone says, the Bravo Real Housewives series is truly documenting people's lives through thick and thin. One of my favorite documentary films is the Up series, which has followed a group of British children from different backgrounds from the ages of 7 through 56 with a new documentary on the same kids produced every 7 years, and it's still going. The late great film critic Roger Ebert considered it one of the greatest films of all time, as you got to see life change and evolve with all its unpredictability. And I consider The Housewives shows a similar kind of documentary filmmaking. And the people on those shows are brave to let millions of people into their worlds. Trust me when I say this with full understanding that if you have never seen any Bravo Housewives shows, these kinds of comparisons will make zero sense and you might be saying to yourself, what the fuck is Michael Rapaport even talking about now? I get it. Trust me, I get it. But you, my friend, are the one who's missing out. Every housewife table flip, wig snatch, or emotional tirade is your loss, not mine. You are missing out on some of the best entertainment of the last 10 years. We are currently in the golden age of television with so many great shows being created and so many different formats to watch them. But don't forget, television was produced to bring simple entertainment into the homes and give families enjoyment. So yes, I love great, complex dramas like Breaking Bad and House of Cards just as much as the next person. And I also appreciate sitcoms like Friends or The Big Bang Theory. But I would put up the unpredictable family dysfunction of The Real Housewives of New Jersey against any Emmy Award-winning show, any one of them. I would also put the wackiness of Real Housewives of New York cast member Ramona Singer and the crying face of Beverly Hills Housewives newcomer Erica Jane up against anything on Comedy Central. This shit's hilarious, it's fantastic, it's entertaining, and it's totally real. So do yourself a favor. The next time you've run out of games to watch or your favorite fancy-ass cold case murder mystery show runs its course, find yourself some Bravo Real Housewives and buckle up your seatbelt for good times and even some genuine tear-jerking drama. Trust me, you won't be let down. And tell the housewives that I sent you. All right, here we go. The people wanted it. I wanted it. Here it is. Michael Rapaport's Real Housewives Top 20 Power Rankings, Volume 1. Number 20, Dorinda Medley, Real Housewives of New York. Immediate breakout star, the blue-eyed shit-talker has finger-pointing skills and hand gestures that commonly make traffic police stop and stare in awe. Medley will mess things up, but always make it nice. Loyal to the core, she continues to stand by her longtime lover, Johnny Cleaners, who should be starring in his very own straight-to-video mob movies. Number 19, Sheree Whitfield, Real Housewives Comeback Player of the Year in 2017. has the best straight face in the game and showed her vulnerable side in 2017, but will still go toe-to-toe with anybody. She famously told NeNe Leakes to fix her face and quickly became a viral sensation. Proudly built Chateau Charest from the ground up on her own dime. Number 18, Cynthia.